Welcome to Masters of Dispute Resolution on Podclips. This podcast is designed to offer valuable perspectives and insights to individuals engaged in the mediation process. Listeners will benefit from the experience of the profession's most accomplished mediators who share compelling stories of conflict and the lessons they have learned from handling challenging and intriguing disputes. Throughout the episodes, you will hear firsthand accounts of how conflict has impacted the lives of those involved and discover how mediation enables individuals to move forward free from the burden of ongoing disputes. The discussions on this podcast provide practical guidance on addressing and overcoming difficult issues, helping listeners achieve more satisfying outcome in mediation. Whether you're a mediator, an attorney, or someone who has participated or is considering participating in mediation, you'll find actionable advice and encouragement. Your host, Len Levy, is a mediator and arbitrator with ADR Services, Inc., a leading provider of alternative dispute resolution. Len brings extensive experience, having litigated complex cases for over 30 years before transitioning to mediation in 1998, and has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution beginning in 2014. Len Levy's expertise and dedication set the stage for insightful conversations and meaningful learning for all listeners. And now, your host, Len Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Season 6 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast designed to add tools to your mediation toolbox. We're brought to you by ADR Services, Inc. and the American Institute of Mediation. Now, in each podcast, you've been hearing a story about conflict, the impact it had on the lives of those involved, how resolution was achieved, and the lessons learned from both the conflict and its resolution. Many of the details may be altered to maintain the essential confidentiality of mediation while still capturing the core of the conflict and its resolution. Now, today we're going to be joined once again by Brad Benning. Brad is one of my favorite guests. His stories are always interesting. It's such a pleasure to have one of the most effective and well-regarded neutrals in Northern California as a guest. Brad has mediated more than 2,000 cases. He's acted as a special master in cases which represent unique challenges to case management and resolution. And he has been uniquely successful in dealing with very difficult, complex mediations, and particularly in the areas of insurance, business, real estate, construction, intellectual property, corporate and partnership disputes, and professional liability. But There are always some interpersonal elements to the mediations that Brad does, and today is not going to be an exception. Today, Brad is going to be talking about a case he's entitled "The Case of the Sexual Socialite," and I can't wait to hear this one. Brad, welcome to Masters of Dispute Resolution.
Well, thank you, Len. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so what happened in this case? I'd like you to set the scene. How did this one set up in terms of the conflict?
Sure. So I think that most neutrals at one time or another, and usually many, many times, they will learn something either prior to the mediation or during the course of the mediation that is a very important card to play that may lead to a resolution. Most of the time, I think neutrals have spoken to the parties before mediation. You're trying to find out if there's something that is a card or an issue that you need to be aware of. Maybe it's a certain sensitivity that a party may have. It may be that you need to keep the parties separate. A whole variety of things that are relevant to trying to make the mediation successful. But one thing that obviously is important is there a card that somebody's going to play in this mediation that either should be played ahead of time or maybe during the course of the mediation? The most common thing I think that most of us have experienced is in a personal injury case, there may be a sub rosa and somebody's been under surveillance and all of a sudden they show up at a mediation and they have this videotape or photographs, and how that card is played and when you play it and how deep do you get into the mediation. And then when you do play it, how do you do it? Do you show it to counsel? Do you show it to everybody? How do you go about making that most effective card be played in a way that's going to have an impact? Well, this case in particular was fairly unique. It involved a couple who were very, very successful, multi-gazillionaires, own multiple houses all over the country, and some in Europe and some even in South America. And it was basically the wife's hobby to design and furnish all of these very elaborate homes all over the world. And she had no budget. It was completely unlimited to do whatever she wanted. And there was kind of a thing among the socialites to have your own custom designer. And so she had this custom designer. I had never really run into something that was quite like this. This designer really had complete carte blanche to, in some manner, all the way down to picking up steak knives and, you know, the things that you would just furnish a house with. And he also charged a significant markup. A very successful gentleman. And he had a lot of these very, very wealthy clients. It was kind of like a badge of honor to be using this designer if you're a wealthy person, and something you would sit around over martinis and talk about how this particular designer and what they were doing for you. So the wife and this designer had a practice of flying to different cities and different countries to go pick out artwork or different kinds of furnishings, etc., or to look at even architectural finishes that they might incorporate into some of these very elaborate homes. It's very interesting because this designer was a very competent gentleman. He also was a licensed architect. And so he was somebody who was very, very talented and, you know, incredible taste, far above my pay grade as far as the kinds of things that they would go out and select. So they would go to, you know, fly first class to New York or Paris or Rome, etc., and go on these very extensive visits and travels, picking out various finishes for these houses. Well, one trip in particular was to Rome. And not only did the designer go, but the designer's partner went along. And the designer was a gay gentleman, very handsome fellow, very engaging. And so the partner and the designer and the wife all flew first class to Rome and were staying at a beautiful hotel. And they were visiting, they even went out to Versailles and were looking at different kinds of finishes in different locations all over Rome. And then in Paris, I think they also went to London. Well, while they were in Rome, they would, of course, go out to very elaborate dinners. And on one particular evening, the wife had, I think, multiple martinis and glasses of wine in. She became a bit tiddly, and maybe more than just a little bit tiddly. And she started kind of making suggestions to these two gentlemen that she had a fantasy of being with two men. And this kind of course, took the designer quite aback, especially since he's gay. And she was quite insistent. It ended up, they had a kind of a big debate about it, but they decided, okay, well, she's kind of our benefactor. We better satisfy her and keep her happy. So they actually went to her room, and they didn't get into details when this was ultimately disclosed to me. They did go to her room, and they had some kind of an adventure that night. And by the way, this was something that I knew nothing about at the beginning of the mediation. It was something I was told there was going to be something revealed, but something that during the mediation, it may be something that I would want to know about. So the way this dispute unfolded was that in one of the homes that's in the United States, there was a dispute with the general contractor that was building the home. Mm-hmm. And the general contractor filed a cross complaint against this designer because there was a lot of issues that had to do with finishes and materials and so on that this designer had specified. So this designer was brought in by way of a cross complaint. While this cross complaint and everything was unfolding, the husband kind of got wind as to what the compensation package was for this designer, because he really had not been on his radar, this very elaborate compensation package. And the husband kind of went ballistic. So they ended up doing a big, huge accounting on all of the projects that this designer had handled. And they ended up having a claim for disgorgement because of various accounting issues of about $500,000. Now, this was pretty significant because even though the designer had errors and omissions coverage with regard to design, a disgorgement claim, meaning paying money back that he was paid, that generally is never going to be covered under a design liability policy. So this was a big deal for this designer. And even though he was very successful to come out of pocket with $500,000 in liquid cash to try to settle his case was going to be kind of a catastrophe for him. So it was a big deal. It was interesting because the case was very aggressively prosecuted against this designer in kind of an angry way, by the way. And he had yet to have his deposition taken, but the discovery had been scorched earth. The lawyer, apparently on behalf of the husband and wife, had been instructed, "Go get this guy." And so they were trying to kind of defame him literally in the neighborhood of all these people that he was representing. So it was a very emotional case for the designer, and it certainly was an emotional case for the husband and wife. Well, this episode that had happened in Rome, where they had had this tryst with this middle-aged, wife, kind of came to fruition because what had happened after that, she had wanted them to continue to have these kinds of rendezvous, and they had refused. They had said, "We're not doing it," and she was basically jilted, and she was very offended and very upset. It was unknown if that was the real reason as to why the case was being so vindictively prosecuted, but the designer felt that it was because she had cut off the relationship. She had terminated him. They had a very close relationship previously where they would talk all the time and text all the time and so on. And that had been completely cut off. Plus, he had, through the grapevine, heard a lot of bad things that she was saying about him. So when we are in the middle of this mediation, and this was a mediation that had about 10 parties, by the way, it wasn't just these two parties. He was just one of many. So about halfway through the mediation that day, the lawyer for the designer pulled me inside and said, "Brad, I've been meaning to tell you about this. I wanted you to know what happened. We think that this might have something to do with the motivation for this wife in being so vindictive in prosecuting a claim against the designer." So the partner was also at the mediation, the designer and his partner. So they, for about a half hour, told me in detail about his relationship with the wife, about this tryst they had while they were in Rome, about the follow-up and the angst. And I said, "Well, she's just going to say it just didn't happen. I mean, what else can she say? She's going to say you're lying. You're just trying to create something out of thin air." He said, "Well, let me show you some texts." And so they had texts that had been on the evening that this tryst occurred saying, "Well, we'll be up in 15 minutes and please go get a bottle of champagne and I'm going to take a shower and be ready for you guys." And, so it was very clear from the context of these texts, there was something that was being arranged. So there was not just, kind of evidence if he said, she said. There was some pretty clear text messages that revealed that they were planning on something that was difficult. And then there also were text messages after he had told her, "We're not going to do this anymore," that were angry and upset. So he had some pretty good evidence. It wasn't just a he said, she said. There was some pretty good evidence. And they had, copies of these texts available for me, not just on their phones, but available for me at the mediation. So this was going to be a challenge because how was I going to play this card, or even whether I should play this card? It could be incendiary. It could blow the whole thing up with a wife. I was unsure how she was going to react. I also knew if I just pulled the lawyer aside and said, "Listen, I got to tell you, Bill, I got this really inculpating stuff that really looks terrible as to what's motivating this wife." And I knew if I told him, and the wife was kind of controlling these settlement discussions, he was going to be in a position, did he need to tell the husband because of this being a variable with regard to impacting settlement and the wife making decisions with regard to settlement? So I did make a decision to pull the lawyer into a separate room. And of course, he was just aghast. He said, "Well, she would never do that. This couldn't happen." I said, "Well, okay, well, let me tell you, I've got both the designer and the partner here, and they have this evidence." And I was able to then produce the texts and show him exactly what had occurred. And of course, he was devastated because he had known this woman for a long time. I guess they'd been personal friends in addition to, and he knew the husband very well as well. So I did not give him a copy of the texts at that time. I said, "You need to go and have a private session, probably with the wife, and talk about whether you really want this guy to be deposed or you want this card to be played in a manner where it's going to come out that they had this tryst and that, and if he's deposed, he was going to be deposed in the very immediate future. The husband's going to learn about all this and it's going to look just absolutely terrible. And also, it's going to be public because you can imagine the embarrassment this woman might feel if it became public that she had had this tryst and all of these really shameful things she was saying about this designer were really motivated because she had been jilted. So Bill, the lawyer, went in and spent quite some period of time. He then brought me in with the wife because she wanted to hear it directly from me that what I'd been advised. And I brought the texts in. Mm-hmm. And of course, she was very, very defensive, saying, well, those are out of context. Those don't mean what they say. What else could she say? I mean, I don't think she could quite admit it. But it was fairly apparent. And one of the reasons I really felt that I did want to see what her reaction was is because we all know when you're in person, especially, and you can get a read when somebody's being confronted with something as to how the reaction is. And it was very apparent to me that this, in fact, had occurred. And she was simply having to do what she could, which is deny, deny, deny.
Let me interject something. There are questions that abound here. First of all, we now have an X-rated construction mediation,
which very, very X-rated,
which is so far off the beaten path.
It was as unusual as that can come. That's right.
That's right. I'm not sure there is a path, but in any event, you've now been told by the designer and the designer's attorney, and I am just going to assume that at some point. The designer said, look, use it the way you want to use it, or this is a confidential communication between the designer's attorney and you. What marching orders or discretion were you endowed with?
So that's a very good point, a good question. One of the things when somebody has what they perceive to be a big card to play, mm-hmm. that may be something that would lead to resolution, you do have to, of course, defer to them as to how they want that card played. This is their case to negotiate. I will always have an opinion and tell them what I recommend, probably, which is what happened here. Mm-hmm. I said, look, if you tell them directly, it's going to really go up. I think I should go in and just have a conversation with the lawyer. And the counsel for the designer agreed, said mm-hmm. that I knew the lawyer for the husband and wife very well and had some good credibility with them. So they left up to my discretion exactly what was said. But I did tell them that I strongly believed it was important to show these texts because you know that the wife is going to be completely denying everything. It's a little bit of a, you know, the problem is also, as sure it's not lost on anybody, it's a little bit of blackmail because what you're really kind of doing is saying, I have this collateral thing that is very negative that may not go to the merits. I mean, the argument was that she was posturing with all these accounting issues and coming up with all these things she said she didn't approve with regard to this claim for disgorgement, and that the motivation was that she had been jilted. So it ended up, it could be relevant to the case. But on the other hand, it's such an incendiary thing for her to have this threesome and be the one who proposed it, et cetera. It's a little bit of blackmail. And so you got to be tactful as a mediator as to exactly how you're going to play that card.
Right.
But well, they pretty much deferred to me as to how to handle it.
Well, that's probably a very good idea. Because you've dealt with situations not like this. No one has, Brad. I am quite sure.
It was a pretty weird one. Pretty weird one, no doubt.
Yes. Yes. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to get into some of the issues that may have arisen. For example, what is the husband thinking about in all of this? So I'm Glenn Levy. We're chatting with Brad Benning, and we'll be back in a moment.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitration, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and my guest is Brad Benning. Brad has been telling a very interesting story, originally in the context of a construction dispute. Brad, it seems like that construction dispute basically morphed into something else. Can you just clarify how that happened?
Sure. So what happened, and the reason this designer originally got involved, was the general contractor had sued the designer, saying you specified some bad materials. There was a bunch of roofing issues that he had this very fancy Italian slate that they had put on that wasn't necessarily compatible with the environment and so on. So he was brought in really on a design basis. But then as they got into it, and it was really the general contractor's lawyer and experts who kind of got into the billings of this designer, this dispute ended up being between the husband and wife and the designer. They filed a direct action against him because they felt the stuff that had been revealed in the accounting that had been explored and investigated by the general contractor led them to believe they had a claim against the designer. So this really was a direct claim against the designer, but we, of course, was still settling or trying to settle the global construction defect case. And the thing that was a bit unique, many, of course, construction defect cases, depending on how sophisticated the parties are, you can't get anybody out separately because they'll have additional insured endorsements and indemnity agreements and things that don't allow you to settle people out separately. And one of my main strategies in handling these complex multi-party cases is to try to get people out of the case separately because that gives it's a catalyst for a global resolution.
Right.
So one of the things I was trying to do is get this designer out of the case and then hopefully encourage everybody else to say, well, gee, if they got out, I want to get out too. The construction part of the case, just the pure construction part of the case, was being mediated at the same time.
Got it. But this one, this particular one, is aspect of the dispute with the reveal that you conveyed to the couple's attorney made the case into a rather, let's say, explosive and sensitive situation on many levels, a marriage, a reputation, relation, never mind the relationship between the designer and the and the client. That seems to have gone by way of the dodo by this time. But you were aware of all of those things all at once. And so how did you decide to proceed to try to get this settled?
So as you might imagine, the designer had their personal counsel involved, but also had defense counsel that was defending the matter through an Arizona emissions policy. Mm-hmm. So both of those lawyers had weighed in with regard to how this card was going to be played. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Arizona emissions carrier wanted to try to, you know, get out of this case as soon as they could, because it was going to be a very expensive, you know, multi-party, the discovery schedule that was going forward. I was also a special master in the case, and the discovery schedule was very elaborate. Mm-hmm. So they wanted that card to be played aggressively, and they wanted it to be something that I used as leverage trying to get the case settled. So I had advised the lawyer, you know, for the plaintiff, for the husband and wife, that we were going to keep this under wraps. This is going to be something that was not going to be made public. And of course, if you play that card and it's public, you lose the leverage with regard to that card being confidential.
Right.
So what we did not settle it that day. The lawyer for the wife felt he had a conflict, which he really probably did, because he had to, did he have to reveal this to the husband? He went out, I think he got an ethics lawyer to kind of give him advice as to what his obligations were, because he didn't want to just settle a case without taking into consideration all of his obligations to everyone. He also did, I believe, confirm that the husband was simply going to leave to the wife discretion with regard to how this case was going to be settled, in particular as to the designer. He also wanted to do his due diligence, and I totally respected that, because showing, you know, texts that are from one side that in theory could be manufactured or fabricated and so on, he wanted to really cross-examine the wife and spend some time with her to see, listen, you've had a host of communications. You need to go look at your own text and your own background information to see if this is valid. I do not know what happened with that, by the way. They did not come back. And I do know that, and I tried to really stay on top of communicating with the husband and wife's attorney fairly quickly, because this was moving into discovery. I do know that the change in their approach to settlement was meteoric. I think they immediately they had been banning $500,000, and it was something that was heavily in dispute on this accounting side. And it was really pretty tough because you really couldn't settle the accounting side of the case and getting a dismissal with prejudice without also settling all of the cases, all the claims that the general contractor had on his cross complaint. And of course, the insurance company wasn't going to want to settle part of the case and leave it, and they're going to want to get the whole thing done. So I ended up having another meeting with the lawyer for the husband and wife after he'd done his due diligence. It was some number of weeks later. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure what happened during that couple of weeks, it had marinated on their side. Mm-hmm. I don't believe the husband was ever advised of the issue. I think,
wow.
Well, I think what happened is that the ethics lawyer, I don't know exactly what happened, but this is my impression. The ethics lawyer had said, listen, you're going to have to advise the husband that you have some confidential information and you do not recommend that you disclose it to the husband. And apparently the husband agreed, as far as I know, because he, as far as I know, he never knew about it. But the lawyer did discharge his ethical duties by telling the husband something, and the husband acknowledging that, okay, this is going to be between you and my wife. That's confidential between the two of you. I'm not going to try to invade the attorney-client privilege as to that issue. But you can imagine how sensitive it was for that lawyer.
Oh, so, my God. An entire minefield of problems, any one of which could explode.
Well, having defended lawyers a significant part of my career, there's no doubt when you have any time, I think lawyers recognize, if you got two people in front of you as clients, you got a potential conflict. They make different decisions. They may not want to settle a case the same. And, you know, and to be required to get a written waiver, you have to supposedly disclose what the nature of the conflict is, right? You can't just say, I got a conflict and you're waiving it. You got to tell them what the nature is. So I don't really know how that got resolved. And it's kind of one of those things where I didn't want to know.
Right.
Because it's not part of my job. It's not my job.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So I do think that the wife had done her due diligence, went back and confirmed that, oh, yeah, there's some pretty bad direct evidence that this tryst occurred and how the breakup happened and how I stopped using this guy, which was also kind of circumstantial evidence that she had been jilted. And the demand had been about $500,000 and some dollars. I don't have my notes with regard to exactly how the settlement unfolded. But the case ended up settling with the errors and omissions carrier only paying some money. The individual designer did not pay anything. He also heavily disputed the accounting issues, by the way. Mm-hmm. He did not pay anything. And so a case that you could arguably say the settlement value as to the accounting issues was $300,000 or $400,000 settled for basically nothing, because she did not want this to come out in any. And if this guy was going to be deposed, she did not want this to be an issue. By the way, he ultimately was deposed, but it was after the case had settled as to him. And so I'd kind of advised him, look, you know, the reason that she settled, and there was a confidentiality provision in the settlement agreement, as you might imagine, and a non-disparagement agreement. Mm-hmm. So, and you could certainly argue that somebody propositioning you for a threesome and then having the threesome would be disparagement. So,
right.
So I think that the skill set of the lawyer who was defending him was as such, saying, you're going to stay far afield. If you're asked a question where you'd have to answer that,
right,
under oath, that's one thing. But you're going to stay far afield from that issue. That's just, for one thing, it would be inconsistent with kind of the informal agreement as well, that if we're going to settle this case, you're going to keep your head down. You're not going to be talking about it.
Right.
So I do know that some number of years later, the husband and wife did get divorced. And I do not know why, but I do know they got divorced. And I don't know if I had heard that he had some trophy wife or something else. I don't know what the history is. And I don't know if it had anything to do with this event whatsoever.
Well, you know, when you were talking about getting a confidentiality agreement, the thing that immediately popped into my mind was, how could you possibly decide on a number for liquidated damages? Or are you even approaching it? I mean, what is the ramification of disclosure in this case? It could have a multi-million-dollar impact.
Right? Well, you know, one of the things about that I always tell people when you have confidentiality agreements, it's a little bit of a death wish if you want to sue somebody under the confidentiality agreement, because the defense is it was not only confidential, And if you're claiming I disparaged you, I'm going to try to prove that it's true. So it's one of those things that's it's kind of a double-edged sword. But we did not have a liquidated damages clause. Mm-hmm. It was just a straightforward confidentiality agreement. You're not going to talk about it. Was broader than typical, meaning usually the confidentiality has to do with the agreement, whereas this was broader, that there was not going to have anything to do with their the ostensible reason was because they didn't want him talking about all the things they designed and how much money they spent on their homes and all the things they did. They wanted that to be a confidential thing. So the confidentiality extended to anything arising out of or related to their relationship.
Oh, okay.
So it was broader than the typical, you know, under the, you know, ostensible reason that she was very sensitive about the services that he had provided, not including the threesome.
Right. Well, you know, another thing that came to mind, it was almost like you hear something and it's like deja vu of a time when I was practicing law and a mediator who was a well-known former justice of the Court of Appeal came to me and said, you know, they've got something on your client and I can't tell you what it is, but it's really bad. And I said, well, what am I supposed to do with that? I mean, there might be something that's impeachment, but I know if I go into my client and say, he says that they've got something really bad, his reaction is going to be, can't be. I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't say anything wrong. And so making a determination or making a decision on what to disclose and what not to disclose after being given carte blanche by the parties to disclose whatever you wanted to, okay, is something that demonstrating a degree of trust that you've established with the parties. We're going to take a break now. Let me tell my audience, results like this don't happen by accident. I think you can really see how Brad was handling this and applying the right mediation tools is a key. So we're going to be right back after from the American Institute of Mediation.
Hi there. We hope you're enjoying another fascinating episode of Masters of Dispute Resolution. Has the show ever made you think about becoming a mediator and doing the work you're hearing these experts doing? Are you thinking about it right now? Imagine a career where you're working to help people in conflict find win-win solutions. The sense of purpose you'll feel can easily be heard in the voices of the guests on this show and its host, expert mediator Len Levy. Or maybe you're a mediator already looking to build your skill set in order to pull off some of the brilliant and out-of-the-box solutions that these guests are talking about. That's where we come in. We're the American Institute of Mediation, and we train mediators of all levels. We're the place you come to learn the basics of mediation or to raise your game in the field. We specialize in mediating commercial and litigated cases, but we teach the skills in such a way that will work in any setting. Our slogan is world-class training for the complete mediator because we feature the world's best mediation trainers and we prepare you for all aspects of being a professional mediator. Find us online at AmericanInstituteOfMediation.com and browse all of our courses that are available for streaming on demand. You can watch our courses at your convenience, at your desk, on a plane, or in bed in your jammies. We'll see you in the mediation world soon.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and my guest is Brad Benning, who has conveyed a story that is fascinating. I apologize for those who believe that going X-rated on this might have brought the podcast into a different direction, but I think we can all handle it, can't we? We're going to be discussing some of the takeaways and some of the valuable lessons to be learned from what happened in this mediation. And you know, one of the things that we had focused on earlier had to do with the disclosure of information and the effect of that disclosure. I will say that there are times that attorneys will tell you in your role of, as mediator, that they have something on the other party. And how that is handled is something that is really case specific. How has that come up for you in the past, Brett?
Yeah, you know, so it's not uncommon. Like I indicated, many times it could be a sub rosa. They got some kind of a photograph, or they got something that's really on somebody. And of course, you know, one of my mantras as a mediator is I have rules that I set up with regard to how to communicate. One of the rules is, and I think everybody has this rule, anything that you want me to keep confidential, I promise I will. Please identify what it is. I will write down. I keep it in my keep it confidential stupid page, because I got to make sure I've kept it confidential. But I certainly have had happen, like you were saying, Len, where somebody say, I just want you to know, Brad, we've got something on them. And you're not authorized to tell them what it is. So, well, okay, well, can I tell them that you got something? Mm-hmm. And I will actually say back, I'll say the words back that they've authorized me to convey, because that's something that they've asked you to keep it confidential, except for this. You want to be sure you're allowing them to play that card as they wish. So I have had it happen a number of times. I just had it happen recently, by the way, where they did have a sub rosa. And I said, well, am I allowed to tell them that you have a just that you have something on them? Am I allowed to tell them you have a video? I mean, what am I allowed to tell them? And they did allow me to tell them they had a video of this guy getting out of his car and doing a bunch of stuff that showed, you know, his rotator cuff wasn't as bad as it was. I did not tell them the specifics. I didn't was not authorized to convey exactly what the video showed. But that was a very effective card to play with regard to getting the case settled. When somebody has something that they do not want you to share, it's just like, we got something on them. If you can say that, that's fine. And the other side, even though they may say, well, they don't have anything, but they may know they do. They may know, oh, wait a minute. Maybe they know about this.
Right.
So even though they deny it, it may be something that they got something in the back of their mind that really could have an impact on them deciding to go forward.
Well, you know, I kind of have been guided by the trial gotcha rule. Okay. It's as someone who has tried as many cases as you have and as many cases as I have, I know how rare, and you know how rare it is to actually have a smoking gun impeachment Perry Mason style thing that you're going to be able to pull on somebody. And giving that away in the course of a mediation could have a ramification, a negative ramification on your ability to prosecute the case.
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
So giving that away on the hopes of settlement is something that attorneys have to think about. Are they going to give this up? I'm not going to be the one making that decision as the mediator, and I know you aren't either, Brad. So,
but you know, a lot of those things, Len, are something, if there's a scope of discovery that required that to be disclosed, this got you to be disclosed, and then you could have a discovery sanction at trial. So you got to make that decision as well, because if you're going to have to disclose it prior to trial, you might as well disclose it in the context of a mediation if you think that it is incendiary enough to where it really will encourage settlement. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the context of the story that you told, if I can envision the wife being on the stand and her motivations for making the allegations that she was making being questioned, and this particular evidence might not be something that would otherwise come up during discovery. I'm trying to imagine how it would.
That's a very good point. I mean, what kind of question you could be asking a designer who's being asked about materials and his accounting and so on, unless you're going to say to him, why do you think the wife is motivated to be going after you? I agree with you. I mean, it may very well simply not come up. So, by the way, just as an aside, I mean, that would be something that is incendiary and really negative for anybody to have this kind of become public, that you had had this threesome when you're married and you had won the proposition and so on. But this socialite was very involved in the local community. She had a lot of charities and a lot of boards she sat on. They were big benefactors to a whole host of different charities in the area. And so this was a big deal for her. I mean, it was not a minor thing. If this had, you know, I don't know that this was something that ever hit the society page, but it's certainly something that would be the subject of lots of gossip.
Right. So the case, as I think you explained, the case did go on, from a standpoint of the contractor's case, was that still proceeding after this resolution?
It took more mediation sessions to settle that globally. But I will say, by getting the designer out, it was a catalyst for everybody else to realize we should try to get this case settled.
So from a standpoint of multi-party mediations, especially, and let's put it in the same context, in construction mediation, there have been times when I've been presented with construction cases where everybody the plaintiff's attorney can possibly imagine ever having worked on the job is included in the case. So the idea of trying to get this get a construction case into segmented parts how do you usually approach that? Is there a usually?
Well, that's a good question. I have at any given time 15 to 20 special master cases that have many, many parties, and I have just other many party mediators. So each one is very different. In some matters, you have a design professional who is key, who does not have indemnity agreements or additional insured endorsements. I have one matter in particular that's about a $12 million out-of-pocket case. I mean, this is money that has been spent, but the general contractor has very extensive indemnity agreements and additional insured endorsements. If you do not have indemnity agreements and additional insured endorsements, it's a little bit of a paradox. It can make it easier to settle because you can pick people off because you can get them out of the case. Mm-hmm. And you can start getting the motivation to, tell if you can go to an insurance adjuster, you can go to a party and say, I know you don't like this, but you got 20 depositions coming up. Give me this amount of money today and you are out. They'll pay their best money. When you can't tell them that, and you have, in this case in particular, we got about 12 parties, you got to do it all at once. And it's unless you have very surgical issues like a stairway or something, then it's very clear and none of the issues overlap because the lawyer who is representing the indemnity mm-hmm. is going to want an issue release. And the plaintiff is going to be very cautious about giving an issue release. So this one in particular is almost exclusively a waterproofing case, and everybody's pointing at everybody else, designers and everybody who touched anything. And so in that context, this is the way I do it, and I've been doing it this way for a long time. I said, look, evaluate your case. I know each one of you is going to tell me, I want to know what everybody else is doing, and then I'll tell you what I'm going to do. So you realize that's what everybody's telling me. It's not going to work. Right. So evaluate your case on a hyper-confidential basis. Tell me what you think. I'm not going to tell anybody unless I have your consent. Tell me what you're ready to pay to get out of the case, because I got to start building this pot. I got to start moving toward resolution. If the matter is in a position where I can really tell somebody, you give me this amount and I'm going to get it done, that's one thing. But if they're just giving you money towards something that's amorphous, they have no idea. If it's a black hole, they don't have any idea what kind of money you're getting from everybody else. It's very unsatisfying. So what I tell them, you give me your best dollar. I will not reveal it until I have your consent or the case settles. And so I've had quite some number of matters where nobody knew exactly who was paying what. They just knew that I've raised $4 million, whatever it is. And then when finally the case settles, I reveal it with regard to what everybody's going to pay. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, you have some people grumbling, saying, oh, God, they got out for too little and I shouldn't have paid more. But I said, well, wait a minute. You evaluated your case.
Right.
And you paid what you thought your case was worth. And everybody can evaluate their case differently. And the fact that you think you paid a little more maybe than somebody else should have paid, why is that relevant if you got out of your case mm-hmm. pursuant to what your evaluation was? So,
an evaluation, what you're putting to the side a bit is things that can arise, such as the sexual tryst thing. How does that affect valuation when you're trying to get someone out of the case from a standpoint of valuing the exposure? Certainly the designer is saying, that case against me, first of all, on its merits, is not particularly good. But also in trial, if this comes out, my case comes by many magnitudes much better.
Well, it's a very subjective thing. It's not like we've done an accounting and your accounting says $1 million and my accounting says 500 grand. It's very different, but it certainly is a very, you know, tangible intangible that has to do with, you know, I just had a matter recently with a plaintiff in a big landslide case, and she's a basket case. I mean, she can't handle the stress. And so there's a subjective variable, even though it's a landslide case, you wouldn't think it's that emotional, but it's her family house that's being impacted. And this is very financially stressful. So I just said to the lawyer after I'd spent a day with them in mediation, she went and threw up during the mediation. She was so upset because I was kind of telling her the facts of life with regard to what might happen. I said, you know, you've got a variable here where that very nice lady cannot sit through deposition and trial. So you have a variable. And that's not an uncommon thing, of course, people who just simply don't have the capacity to handle the kind of stress that is involved in going through litigation, because, of course, you know, you're going to have a talented lawyer on the other side who's good on cross-examination, who's going to try to make you look wrong, bad, and stupid. And if you don't like stress, there is a very a good example. I know almost every lawyer, certainly every mediator, has had something like that, where they have somebody who just does not have the capacity to handle the stress.
We could get into an entire discussion about some of the client-centric, what I call client-centric issues, you know, where we start talking about the further the getting to yes, Fisher and Urey concepts of advancing the client's interests and what interests are unique to this particular case. How do you advance those interests? So does the client, as you just explained, does the client have the capacity? And I'm not just talking about financial capacity. You're not talking about that. Do they have the emotional capacity to proceed? What are they trying to accomplish here? There are a whole host of questions that can be asked and should be asked. And we just don't have the time to get into all of them. But Brad, this has been an absolute pleasure. I am so pleased to, again, be able to talk with you and just hear an interesting story. You tell the stories well. You just do.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me to do it, Len.
Okay. Well, look, as we wrap up, how can listeners best contact to book you for services and, you know, as a special master or as a mediator?
You go to the ADR services website, that will have all the ability to contact me, and my case manager is right there. And that's a very straightforward method. People are also welcome to email me directly at bbenning@adrservices.com. And Benning is just one N in the middle.
Very good. Brad, thank you again. And I appreciate this conversation and hope once again, we'll have you back sometime in the future as a guest. And thank you, Daryl Wayne, who's my engineer and producer. I'm your host, Len Levy, and this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Invigen Labs, Inc. I hope you will continue to enjoy the stories we bring you. And in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com. Telephone him at 818-903-5562 or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.